back to some pirate theology this morning, and it only took us to February, but at long last we have arrived at the godfather of holy piracy himself, the person we know as the Apostle Paul. Kester Bruin says this: pirates emerge whenever economies become blocked. In Paul's day, the social, religious, political economies were severely blocked, and Paul would proceed to smash through all of them. The trouble is, we find that hard to see a little bit, and so I want to help us this morning recover the spirit of Paul's piracy by bringing him into dialogue with one of his actual contemporaries, a man named Pliny. And both Pliny and Paul wrote letters in their day, and they both happened to write a letter about similar circumstances, what you do with a runaway slave. And what I want to do is compare and contrast the way they handle and approach the issue. And to do that, I want to look hard at their letters. Now, letters have become a bit of a foreign concept to us, haven't they? When was the last time you received a letter in the mail? My guess is that for some of the younger people here, you probably have never received a letter. For those others of us, it might have been years. In fact, the whole idea of letter writing is weird. We still get from some distant relative of Kristen's, one of her aunts or something, still writes a Christmas letter to everyone. Does anyone else still do this? Good, because I'm going to make fun of them. They're so weird, right? They're so weird. Like, we get this every Christmas. I haven't talked to them ever in my life, and they're like, Merry Christmas, let me tell you all about the family. And so, you know, little cousin Jody's doing this, and it's just, it's a bizarre thing, because I don't care. But anyway, I get these Christmas letters every year. Letters are a funny, odd thing. Hardly anyone writes them anymore. They're quickly becoming a thing of a past, though I did stumble on something this week that I thought was hilarious. There's a website, another art project called Dear Blank, and it encourages people to write in very short imaginary letters, and some of them I thought were hilarious, so I thought I'd share some of them with you. Here's the first one. Dear icebergs, sorry to hear about the global warming. Enjoy the karma. Sincerely, the Titanic. Dear Waldo, please return my invisibility cloak ASAP. Sincerely, Harry Potter. Dear Twilight fans, thank you for making us look sane and well-adjusted. Sincerely, Trekkies, you know. Dear windshield wipers, can't touch this. Sincerely, that little triangle. Right? Yeah. Dear musicians, please stop putting sirens in your songs. Sincerely, just slammed on my brakes. This is one. I had a nightmare last night. Dear subconscious, so I can't finish the good dreams, but the nightmares have sequels. Sincerely, we need to talk. Dear Noah, we could have sworn you said the ark wasn't leaving till 5. Sincerely, the unicorns. I like this one. Dear movie watcher, your parents are about to walk in. Sincerely, the only sex scene in the movie. Right? Yeah. Yeah. And dear Diet Coke, I feel you're overreacting. Sincerely, Mentos. It's good. I'm gonna try that one. Man, imaginary letters, they're funny. But in day-to-day life, right, email has basically replaced the whole idea of letter. But in the ancient world, it was the only way to communicate with one another outside of face-to-face contact. And so we have both this Pliny guy and Paul writing letters. They're both prompted by some kind of problem they're facing. A slave has run away. Someone needs advice. And so we have these ancient letters. And they're so fascinating to me. It's like eavesdropping in on like a different era in history. But what I think we find in these letters is still very instructive today. So I want to introduce you to the Pliny family. The letter we're going to look at is from Pliny the Younger. For you history buffs, that's not Pliny the Elder. Pliny the Elder was a contemporary of Paul, but he died, no kidding, during the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, AD 79. So he was like a naturalist and was curious, hey, this volcano's going off. So he sailed closer to it and, never heard of again. So that's Pliny the Elder. He never returned, and his nephew, Pliny the Younger, he wrote about that. And then Pliny the Younger, he was quite the character in his own right. He was an important man in the Roman world. He served as a senator, a consulate, a lawyer. He eventually was dispatched to what would now be northern Turkey to be the governor there. And, Trajan was emperor at the time. And we still have letters of correspondence between Pliny and Trajan. And it's interesting because Pliny asked Trajan about policy issues. And one of the letters, he asks about what to do with these Christians that were causing a nuisance. So that's kind of interesting. But the letter I want to focus on this morning, he's writing to someone about a runaway slave. Now, Slaves. Let's just address something out of the gate. In any time, period, any form, slavery is evil. But in the ancient world, anyone could be a slave. And so today, I think we have notions slavery is sort of tied to ethnicity and gender. But slavery was different back in ancient times. Anyone could be a slave. If your city got sacked, even if you were rich, high up, you would become a slave, or you could sell yourself into slavery. And so slavery was more than gender or ethnicity. And so both Paul and Pliny are going to write about slaves. And there's some remarkable similarities and differences to how they approach it. But Pliny's situation starts out this way. An unnamed young man, we don't ever know his name, he refers to him as a freedman, which was someone who had maybe worked their way out of slavery but was still completely dependent on their former owner. This unnamed guy has offended Pliny's friend Sabinianus. And this is what Pliny counsels his friend. Pliny the Younger to Sabinianus, you told me you had been angry with a freedman of yours, and now he's come to see me. He threw himself at my feet and clung on to me as though I were you. He wept a lot, he asked for a lot, though he kept quiet about a lot too, but to sum it up, he made me believe he was genuinely sorry. I think he's a changed character, because he really does feel that he did wrong. Yes, I know you're angry, and I know too that you have a right to be angry, but mercy earns most praise when anger is fully justified. Once you love this fellow, and I hope you will love him again, for the moment, it's enough if you let yourself be placated. You can always be angry again if he deserves it, and you'll have all the more reason if you've been placated now. He's young, he's in tears, you have a kind heart. Make all that count. Don't torture him, and don't torture yourself either. Anger is always torture for a soft heart like yours. I'm afraid it will look as though I'm putting pressure on you, not simply making a request if I join my prayers to his, but I am going to do it anyway. And are them all the more fully and thoroughly because I've given him a sharp and severe talking to. And I've warned him clearly that I won't make such a request again. This was because he needed a good fright. And I said it to him rather than you because it's just possible that I shall make another request and receive it too. Always supposing it's appropriate thing for me to ask and for you to grant. Yours sincerely, Pliny the Younger. So, something's gone wrong. We don't know what exactly, but something has gone wrong between this freedman slave and Sabinius, and Sabinius is angry. And Pliny's advice to him is intriguing and telling. I want to showcase a few things about his approach. First, the social hierarchy at work here. Pliny is high up. He's in the upper echelons of society. Sabinianus, he's upper middle class, and of course you've got this unnamed person who's low, low, low. And so he gives the man a good talking to, and he decides that as a man of high standard, he can give advice to a middle class guy about someone who's low. And I find that interesting. So, high, middle, low. Keep that in mind when we get to Paul's. Second, the nature of his advice is interesting. It stands well to reason, but I love that he sort of plays his advice's aim towards Sabinianus's pride and reputation. Listen to his words. Mercy earns most praise when anger is fully justified, and anger is always torture for a soft heart like yours. So his advice is based on, here was what be best for you, Sabinianus. This will do well for your pride and reputation. And then, of course, there's this big power move here. Pliny tells him what he should do. I always suppose it's appropriate for me to ask and for you to grant. And so in the end, we have a slave begging someone really high in power to have someone middle in power show the low person in power mercy. That's what he does. He pulls a power move here. But what I find interesting about this letter, this contemporary of Paul, is in the end, everyone stays in the same place within the social hierarchy as when they started. So at the end of the day, Pliny is still going to be up here. Sabinianus is going to be here. Unnamed slave is going to remain down there. Pliny's advice, which feels more like a command, you could say, is, listen, you're angry, but this is going to look so good if you show some mercy. This is going to look good on you. People will think you're something special. Besides, being angry isn't a good look for upper middle class people. So just, let this go. Kind of like Frozen. Let it go. Let it go. Let it go. Just let it go. Just be placated. Let it go. He'll stay down there. You'll be fine. Just let it go. I want to contemporize things for us. What might Pliny's advice look like in a situation today? Well, I need to tell you about a little incident I had this week. It wasn't good. I took the kids to judo at the community center. My two oldest are in judo at the community center, which is essentially, I pay a little bit of money for a glorified form of them playing tag. And so we're at the community center, they're doing judo, they bow, then they play tag, and they run around laughing. It's great. But as a gesture of kindness to Kristen, I take Evie with me so she can have some time on her own. And so Evie and I sit there watching. And Evie likes to whisper. She likes to kind of run around a little bit. And I stay quiet, but you can run around a little bit. So she's doing her thing when suddenly this other dad sitting a few seats down goes, excuse me, don't you think your kid's being distracting? I was like, whoa. Now, next slide. I'm working hard to get you on my side here, because how can a grown man be upset at that? That's Evie, right? Now, she was being distracting, but I didn't like the tone, and the Irish in me got really going. And I said, no, I don't think she's being distracting. Nobody else seems to have a problem with it. And so he's like, yeah, well, I'm going to go and talk to the people at the front desk how distracting your daughter is. I was like, fine. So he leaves and goes talking to the people at the front desk, and I'm going, oh my goodness, this is getting tense. I don't know what to do. I'm getting worked up. And so I go out in the hall to meet him on the way back. So I see him talking to the front desk people, and then he starts walking back. And I probably said something I shouldn't have that elevated the tension. But as he's walking back, I said, so what's the verdict there, champ? Yeah. I was a little riled. Probably could have left the champ part behind. That didn't go well. So then there are two grown men discussing what counts as distracting. So we're getting a little heated. I'm like, well, you came in late, and that was distracting. And you took a phone call in the middle of class. That was distracting, too. Oh, yeah? And all of a sudden, I'm like, oh, my goodness, I'm that guy. I'm weird dad guy. And I had like a Pliny impulse in me that just, I could hear Pliny just, this don't look good. You don't look good. Anger doesn't look good on you, Brad. Just let it go. And so we kept going and finally said, life's too short for petty stuff like this. I'm out of here. So I just went back in, made Evie sit nice and quiet. That was the end of it. But this, something had clicked in me that reminded me getting heated and awkward and angry is not a good look. And so this Pliny impulse became something that I could relate to. This idea of, listen, I know things in life make us angry, but just let it go. Keep the status quo. And besides, if you handle this well, Brad, you could look really virtuous. Now, it might be a little late for that for me, but the important thing for Pliny in a conflict situation is to maintain the status quo, nothing change, and to make sure you come out of it looking virtuous. Now, Paul's approach to an issue like this has some similarities, but some differences as well. So this letter comes from Paul. He's in prison, presumably under house arrest, and along comes a runaway slave named Onesimus. And this is not just any runaway slave. The runaway slave belongs to, at this point, a man named Philemon. And Philemon was Paul's friend and a fellow church planter. They had planted a church together. And so we don't know exactly what happened between Onesimus and Philemon. There's some indication maybe Philemon stole something and ran away. We don't know. But there's a falling out. And so Onesimus comes to Paul, and this puts Paul in a very difficult situation. What's he going to do? The prevailing wisdom of the day would have said, well, Paul, just try to placate the situation. just try to make sure everybody gets calmed down. Maintain the status quo. Have Philemon come out of this looking virtuous. What does Paul do? Well, he does something quite risky. He sends Onesimus back to Philemon with a letter for him. And the letter begins with an icebreaker, some greetings, a bit of flattery, and then we pick it up partway through. My dear brother, your love gives me so much comfort and joy. You have refreshed the heart of God's people. This is to Philemon. Because of all this, I could be very bold in the king and order you to do the right thing, but because of love, I'd much rather appeal to you. Yes, it's me, Paul speaking, an old man as I am, and now a prisoner of King Jesus. I'm appealing to you about my child, the one I have fathered here in prison, Onesimus, Mr. Useful. There was a time when he was useless to you, but now he's very useful to you and to me. I'm sending him to you, yes, the man himself, and this means sending my own heart. That way, when you did the splendid thing that the situation requires, it won't be under compulsion, but of your own free will. Look at it like this. Maybe this is the reason he was separated from you for a while, so that you could have him back forever. No longer as a slave, but much more than a slave, as a beloved brother. Beloved especially to me, but how much more to you, both as part of your household and in the Lord. So anyway, if you reckon me a partner in your work, receive him as though he was me. You start to get the sense here that Paul sounds a bit like the Godfather here, a bit like a mob boss. And now that my hand has been forced, I'm going to give you my best Marlon Brando to finish off the letter. If he's wronged you, Philemon, in any way, if he owes you anything, he put that on my account. This is me, Paul, writing with my own hand. I'll pay you back. Far be it from me to remind you, you owe me your very self. Yes, my brother, I want some benefit from you in the Lord. Refresh my heart in the King. As I write this, I'm confident you'll do what I say. In fact, I know you'll do more than I say. But at the same time, get a guest room ready for me. I'm hoping to see you, that through my prayers, I will be granted to you. The grace of the Lord, King Jesus, be with your spirit. That was bad. That felt more weird Italian. I should have worked on that a little bit. But I love this letter so much because Paul is full out Godfather mob boss here. I want to start with an obvious comparison between this letter and Pliny's, and that's this. Both Pliny and Paul use power moves in how they handle the situation. There are big power moves at play here in both of these letters. Now, what do we think of that? Are power moves ever appropriate? Well, I want to compare these letters, shall we? I think the first thing to say is simply this. Power exists. So we can never rid the world of power because power simply exists. There a multitude of ways to get and use power. You can get power from your gender or the color of your skin. You can also get power based on being competent or achieving something or being attractive or a personality or character. I mean, there are millions of ways to get and use power. A lot of that is situational. It depends on the context, but some ways of obtaining and using power are more legitimate than others. But the reality is this, power exists. And it's allotted to people on a whole lot of different factors. And so the question to me, should people have power? It's kind of like asking, should people have like gravity? It doesn't make a ton of sense. Gravity exists, power exists. Some people have more than others. That's not fair. But to me, the better question is, how should people who have power use it? Power exists, so how do we use it? And note what Pliny does with his power. Maintain social order. Maintain social hierarchy. Expect people to do what you want based on your power. That's Pliny's power move. But what is Paul doing with his power? Well, the interesting thing to me is this. Pliny finds his power in his social standing. Paul finds his power in lack of social standing. He roots his sense of power in not having any social standing. He makes two points that he brags about in his letter. First, that he's old. And second, that he's a prisoner. And these are two things that I would say in both ancient times and today, they signal someone who has no claim to power. I mean, why would anyone listen to someone who's in jail? Let's be honest, would you? Someone writes you from jail, hey, I've got some advice for you. Well, really? And so Paul, he brags about having low social standing. He roots his power in Jesus' kingdom. And of course, in Jesus' kingdom, all notions of power are turned upside down. And so Pliny writes from a high position to Sabinianus in a middle position about someone in a low position. And Pliny has the power on top. But Paul, on the other hand, roots his power in being low and writes to somebody high about what to do with somebody low. I think that's absolutely fascinating. Someone from below, rooted in Jesus, playing a bit of a power move. I think that's fascinating. But what else does he do? It's interesting. He starts by encouraging Philemon before he asks him to do a very hard thing. He starts with encouragement. You see, my dear brother, your love gives me so much joy and comfort. You've refreshed the heart of God's people. I mean, it's so instructive to me that he starts with encouragement, a reminder. Good things are happening. Good things are being done. Philemon, you're a good man. You've done good things, but there's more to be done because something's gone wrong in your community. And I've thought to myself, I think that's always the way community goes. Something always goes wrong eventually, no matter how good loving a community is, no matter how much good work has been done, no matter how much people in community are growing or becoming, no matter how well-intentioned we are in community, things will go wrong. They always do. And Paul knows this, so he encourages Philemon because we all need that when things start to go south. And then he encourages him and goes in for the hard ask. And again, this is a little heavy. Think of his highlighted lines here. I could be very bold in the king and order you to do the right thing, but I'd appeal to you instead. If he's wronged you in any way, owes you anything, put that down in my account. I'll pay you back. I'm confident that you'll do what I say. In fact, you'll do more than what I say. At the same time, get a guest room ready for me, which to me is a bit like, I'm coming to check up on you. I mean, come on, he lays it on pretty thick here. I could order you, but let me help you understand why this is the right thing to do. You owe me your life, of course, but, you know, we don't need to mention that. There's no question this is a power move by Paul, but I would argue strongly it's a fantastic example of power being used in the best possible way. And I also want to suggest that this move was incredibly risky and not nearly as powerful as Paul could have played his hand. I mean, consider how risky this is for Onesimus, a victim of slavery. And Paul says, I want you to go back with a letter. That's a big risk for Onesimus. What if he kills me before he reads the letter? I could be beaten. I could be abused before he even opens the thing. That's risky and dangerous. Well, yeah, it is. The Christian path is risky and dangerous. Are you saying, Brad, that the Christian path asks a lot from victims? Yes, 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 it does. This is risky. And so Paul's performing this dance here. He's operating, you would say, with this, like, knife-edge delicacy, because Paul's giving this letter to Onesimus and having him, the runaway slave, deliver it. But you know who else this is risky for? This is risky for Philemon, because Philemon's about to be asked to do something that had been unheard of in history. This is not a welcome back the runaway slave in the Pliny kind of way, as in, forgive it. Just put him back to work kind of thing. Just brush over it. Paul isn't asking him to sweep it under the rug. He's not asking him to look good in the process. He's asking him to welcome back Onesimus as a brother. Welcome the runaway slave as if this slave was Paul himself. Welcome him back. Oh. If he does that, do you know what the neighbors are going to be thinking? This is dangerous, because here's what the neighbors are probably going to be thinking. Whoa, 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 whoa. I see how these Christians treat runaway slaves. This Paul guy is soft on slavery. What if my slave runs away and comes back with a letter from Paul as well? What then? What if that starts happening all the time? Then what? Good question. Then what? Well, then the world would be in trouble. It would be turned upside down, its head. Exactly. Maybe it would. Therein is the danger. There's a massive risk to everyone involved here. And sure, Paul is working a power move here, but consider what power might have looked like. First, he could have just helped Onesimus escape. This is getting bad. He could have helped Onesimus escape. He could have simply said, I'm keeping Onesimus because he's useful to me. Or he could have been flat out said, listen, slavery is evil and needs to end. It needs to be smashed. Smash the slavery. Be done with it, Onesimus. And the justice part of us really wants that in this letter, I think. But Paul has something bigger in mind. He is about to put a time bomb onto slavery, but Paul is thinking bigger than this. You see, the key to Paul was this. Thing. I'm switching my mic here. Where did that one go? There we go. There we go. Where was I? Can't remember. Right. Justice. Why doesn't he just say, end it? End it. Free Onesimus, free all your slaves, be done. And again, I think it's because Paul has something bigger in mind. And I think the bigger thing is this. For Paul, it's never enough to simply say, let's forget about it. In the book of 2 Corinthians, Paul talks about us being ministers of reconciliation. And for Paul, the ministry of reconciliation was massive. Paul believed that through Jesus, the whole world would be reconciled. Everything at odds, everything we know in this world in tension, will one day be reconciled. And we are now the stewards of that. And so for Paul, the ministry of reconciliation is as big as the entire cosmos, but it's also as small as two people. Two people. And it's not good enough for Paul to simply say, let's subvert that. No, there's some reconciliation to be done here. The primary thing for Paul is reconciliation, and everything else after that is negotiable. And what Paul, as Godfather, is doing is suggesting, welcome him back, Philemon, reconcile, then set him free. Reconciliation, then freedom, because in reality, reconciliation is the only thing that will ultimately bring freedom. And so you have Paul standing in the middle, trying to wrap one arm around Philemon, the other around Onesimus, saying, come, let us abandon the way of Pliny. Let us abandon the way of revenge. There's something much better than that. And so Paul opts for something dangerous and risky. Things could go really, really wrong. But the thing to me about Paul is this. No one in the ancient world was thinking like this. No one was thinking like Paul. And I would say very few people today are thinking like Paul. Wrapping one arm around this party, another around the other party. No one in the ancient world was attempting reconciliation across the largest cultural barrier of the day, but Paul was, because he saw himself as a minister of reconciliation, and he's charged us with the same task. What Jesus launched, what Paul passionately carried the mantle of, was, I would say, it's a new way of being human, living an entirely different mode. And here's the thing, this way doesn't come with big fanfare. It doesn't take the world by storm. This new way of being human, the way of reconciliation, it starts person to person, household by household, family by family, community by community. And this is how Christianity spread in the second and third centuries as Rome was trying to stamp it out. Something was catching on. People were forgiving each other. They were coming together across cultural barriers, and nobody had ever seen anything like this. Men and women, Jew and Gentile, slave and free. And I'm convinced it's in the small acts of forgiveness and reconciliation that the axis of our world is tilted. That is how Jesus saves and redeems, through people like you and me refusing to play into the Pliny impulse, just let's make sure things stay as they are, refusing to give in to the revenge impulse. Jesus saves through us being ministers of reconciliation. And so this morning, I'm thinking about angry dad. I'm thinking a lot about angry dad because the reality is this, I'm going to see him again on Tuesday. And it's going to be awkward. And I feel like I have
a few paths in front of me, and I know the one I want to take the least. I could play the plenty impulse. I could show up. I'm going to leave Evie at home. I'm going to sit there quietly. I'm just going to pretend nothing happened, stare forward, hope we don't even have to talk. Just make sure everything goes along nice and neat. The more attractive option to me is to bring Evie, encourage her to play, make sure my phone makes all sorts of incredibly annoying beeping noises, cough, just, you want distracting? I'll show you distracting. I could push towards the revenge impulse, or I can take the path of Jesus. I can choose to be a minister of reconciliation. And the path, I think, would be this. Maybe making some gesture of reconciliation with him on Tuesday. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know what's going to win out. I honestly don't. This is an ongoing issue. Pray for me. I'm going to need it. Because I really don't. Because all it would take, it would be one more little snide comment from him, and I'd go back into angry Brad mode. But that's who I'm thinking about this week. Which path am I going to take? Path of Jesus? Risky? Dangerous? Path of plenty? Just pretend everything's fine. Path of revenge? Annoy him? I don't know. That's who I'm thinking about this morning. I want to ask, who are you thinking about? You are ministers of reconciliation. So who's on your mind this morning? Maybe it's someone you need to reconcile with. Maybe you have your own angry dad in life. Maybe you have friends who are at odds, and maybe you could, like Paul, step into the middle, wrap one arm around one, wrap an arm around the other, and try to be a bridge builder. I don't know, but I'm inclined to think this. We all have areas where we could be working at reconciliation. For some, it might be working for reconciliation with our First Nations. For others, perhaps it's another group, but I think for all of us, it starts here, person to person, household to household. So I want to ask the band to come and close us with song Guiding Light, and I think it's a great song in that it helps us focus. It helps us and reminds us where to look for our source of life. And I think the reality is this. I believe in my head that the path of Jesus is the best possible way to live life. When it asks me to practice certain things, that's more tricky. But I still believe it's the best possible way to live. And so this morning, may God's Spirit give you both, you and I, the courage and fortitude to choose the path of reconciliation. May Christ Jesus be our guiding light and lead us further down the very risky road of reconciliation. Dave.